listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast coming at you forwards in time, backwards in time, and sideways in time. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
Well, I'm a pointy bit of chalk and a gaudily hilted prop sword for this one, so you watch yourself.
It's about to get a trifle sharpish on the battlefield.
It's a really terrible prop sword, isn't it? Something that gets to be in close.
It's on all the time. And I'm thinking, didn't I get this in a show bag?
This is part of the 1988 Doctor Who show bag, which the year before had invisible ink and a cut-out pregnant-looking Mary Tam. She's in this and all, isn't she? Guess who we've got?
We've got Jean Marsh.
We have.
And we've got Angela Douglas.
We have. Carry on, Brigadier. Actually, was Jean Marsh in a Carry On? She wasn't. She should be.
I don't believe she was. No, but she I wasn't. Could be wrong.
She was a bit too class for that.
I was saying to you during the week, Richard, I'm surprised that fewer Carry On actors were in The Avengers. You know, we've had a few.
The Avengers
in Doctor
thought Who. Themselves saw themselves a little bit middle to high brow for what they were doing,
they
didn't lampoon themselves quite that way.
They had half the cast of Dad's Army.
Yeah, well, class, and Dad's Army didn't start till late 67.
Ah, well, but no, I just found that odd because, of course, Angela Douglas was the female lead in about three or four Carry-Ons, I think.
She was. Carry-On up the Khyber. No, I'm not joking.
And Carry-On up the Jungle.
Why is it up every
She's always in a... Don't you love how these seasons have started? You know, for one of them, we've got an extraordinary moment in, you know, above the earth, hovering with malcontent and fizzling with expectation. And then another season, we have a starburst and the death of a doctor. And now we have a lovely garden centre and some retired people.
I think that's the best opening. I think that's why... Why people like this season so much is it starts
It's like
the
every villain is going to be Patricia Rutledge, you expect.
And I have to say, Richard, I think great minds think alike here because our dear listener, Other Pete, made the same observation.
No, he did not.
During
did
the viewing marathon.
He did
yes.
not, did he? Oh, God love you, Other Pete. Get off my patch.
It's a lovely opening, and it is in a way...
They said that of him as well.
Well, you know, when we had all of that sort of introduction of who the Brigadier was and stuff in Mordred Undead, you know, now Sergeant Benton's a used car dealer and all of that sort of thing. That was
yeah,
all
no
sort of...
better than he ought to be either.
But this is really terribly
wasn't that fronty of them to say that to? How I mean, where's Mike Yates now? He runs a fish shop, doesn't he?
They don't even mention him.
Next to a primary school.
And in Richard Franklin's novel Operation Hate.
Oh, ow. That really hurt.
I believe it is implied that, of course, Yates had his dishonourable discharge with the dinosaur invasion. But, of course, that novel is also about Yates coming to terms with his sexuality.
Ew.
In a time that was, you know, difficult. So Richard Franklin has said, yes, this is semi-autobiographical and I'm putting some of my own life into Yates' life.
It's still in publication.
So originally it was called The Killing Stone and it's been rewritten and retitled Operation Hate, which I believe is still in publication. And people have said it's not actually bad.
Wasn't that the third reboot of Thunderball with Joan Collins as Fatima Blush? Everything goes blurry in the wash, doesn't it?
And George
with George Lazenby as Bond.
George Takei as Fiona Volpe.
Actually, I would so pay to watch that. I will. Do you know why this show is so freaking great, kids? It's not for any of the lovely garden scenes. I'm staying in the bloody garden scenes. I love it. How the hell did he get that house? I think Doris.
No.
I think he married up.
Yeah.
I think it's Doris's money. This is the same universe as Ambassadors of Death. Get it? Get it? No, it really is. Mars landings in the 70s. Mm-hmm. Britain has a space program. I know, okay, it's still Doctor Who, so of course it's the same universe, but it is actually linked in really nicely.
You know what? I think you're onto something there, though, with the Brig marrying up, because when he leaves, Doris asks, does all this mean so little to you? As
yeah.
if this is what she is offering. Yeah, this
Am
is
I
her house.
Am I just your cash cow?
Yeah, this is her
then.
House. She answers the phone.
She does too, doesn't she?
And when at the end she's like make dinner for us.
Yeah, because you are my biatch. B for biatch, Brig.
Except that the name Doris, of course, comes from Planet of the Spiders, remember.
When she gave him a nice watch.
And she's a bit of a scrubber in...
Well, that's right. I thought she was a sort of good time girl and he was kind of...
Just say she wasn't.
He was sort of embarrassed to have had this liaison with her in Brighton, presumably while still married to Fiona.
Volpe. He was still very starchy, though, in the 70s were... That's Sutek agrees. Yeah, he was very starchy. She's so judgy, isn't she?
But no, those opening scenes are properly charming. It. And
this is closest Doctor Who gets to The Man Born. This is Doctor Who does sitcom. And it's really time we had this. There's so much. I don't want to get to the hastily rewritten end scene, because you know that this was meant to be the last story of the brig. And that there were, in fact, as Nick let spill in one of the things, it was the end of the death of the Greyhound. So they did, in fact, rehearse two tag scenes, two end scenes.
So I think that the narrative still is building up to the death of the Brigadier.
Very much so.
Because, you know, we see him suit up, we see him decide to go back. We even see the moment where he would have been killed, where the destroyer...
Yeah, all full of busty promise, standing there twitching away like a would-be extra for a Mel Gibson casting call, covered in woad and full of mock Scottish promise.
No, well,
even for a poll, anyway. I think, is he the greatest poll of the season? Marek Anton?
Oh, my word.
Oh, listen, if you could only have seen young Brendan's face light up, it was like he got full tilt on the pinball.
We'll see more of him in a couple of weeks, yes.
Oh, I see quite a bit of him here, isn't he? Is it just in my head that he's got a blue-painted chest? Do you actually not see it in this?
No, you do. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you pause and your sad old VHS is stretched like a tacky old bit of playground rubber band by the end of it because you've been pausing on that scene for so long.
There's a photograph with... Sue Mansfield fitting his head, as it were.
Oh,
and he's not wearing anything.
Right in front of her salad.
Gigantic nipples right in front of her salad.
Is he still with us?
I think so. Well, of course, we had our viewing marathon for this a couple of weeks ago, and we were watching from various locations. I think you were having work done in your bathroom.
Mm, not a euphemism.
No. But no, James and I were sitting together watching Marek Anton in Curse of Fenric and just kind of gushing, as it were. And I believe I found a website of a Marek Anton. The face shape is similar. He looks very different, of course, because it's 30 years on. But he's aged rather well, so it seems he's still with us.
Oh, he's still doing bathroom renovations in London, like most Polish gentlemen.
That is a euphemism. Now, something I really love about those early scenes with the brig, I kind of like and I kind of don't like the disillusionment in Mordred Undead, because... a lot of season 20 relates to the destruction or erosion of dreams. Snake Dance, for instance.
Yes.
Terminus, of course, you know, people are promised a cure, but just kind of thrown in a radiation chamber and we hope for the best.
Given Sarah Sutton instead.
In Enlightenment, you know, the Eternals basically want to be able to dream and they can't.
Mm.
You know, with UNIT, it was kind of seen as this golden age of Doctor Who even then, but... what Mordred Undead does is goes, no, this is the real world. You know, soldiers do retire and they do go on to prosaic day jobs. Well, this kind, it still honours that because Doris refers to the teaching.
I think, that's what rescued him. They obviously had a falling out. He'd had a breakdown. Oh, this is such a soap, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
I'm surprised that... that Russell didn't refilm all of this. No way, he probably did. But yeah, then she rescued him from his...
So he goes from...
from his bitter chalk.
Yeah, he goes from living in like a studio caravan on the school grounds to this grand old country house with a wife who adores him. It's reclaiming some of that, but also still honouring what's come before. It's one of the more deft moves of continuity we have in the 1980s, because you don't need to have seen that he was a teacher in order to understand that scene.
Yeah, better not to, really.
Yeah. I think the one sort of flaw in that scene is where poor Doris has to say, "You don't regret it, do you?" And he's like, "Regret what? Leaving United Nations Intelligence Task Force."
binary location 0102.
And you kind of go, oh yeah, that kind of makes sense. People
from
need to know what it is.
Bush, but it's central.
Like, anyone who knows what unit means, if she just says unit, will understand it. Anyone who doesn't know what unit means is still going to go, United Nations Intelligence Task Force. What the hell is that?
Yeah, no.
It's the Blofeld moment from Spectre.
We're back to that, aren't we?
But yeah, Angela Douglas, charming. It's a really strong female cast in this one.
Angela Bruce and Angela Douglas actually conflate in my head. I don't know how, but I really would have liked to have seen some standoffs between them. But we'll get that, won't we, Miss Whittaker? We will.
Well, I mean, but later on, UNIT becomes a sort of completely female organisation. I think they're all women in the Zygon invasion and the Zygon inversion, apart from a few grunts.
This is really prescient, isn't it? It's the first time that it's actually looked like something from the United Nations that has a little bit groovy casting.
Yeah. Well, so you have Zbigniew and you have, you know, actual people who are from other countries.
You know
countries.
Who he is, don't you? He's Frobisher in the audios.
Yes, he really.
Robert Jezek.
He's Frobisher.
Wow.
I know. Isn't it great? Don't you wish? Thrown a bit of that in.
But what it does, and it's what happened so rarely, was to bring an element of the past back and give it something completely new to do. And when I say completely new, I guess the nearest analogue is the Demons, where we see UNIT confronting the devil, in essence, and magic and stuff like that. And it is given a scientific explanation, but Miss Hawthorne points out, well, that scientific explanation is just going to say that, yes, magic is real. So we have had UNIT facing magic and the supernatural. Here we have it again, in a really sort of sword and sorcery way, something that we've never seen UNIT confront. You know, it was endless sort of aliens invading the home counties. Here we have something really different where UNIT confronts this myth, this Arthurian myth, where it confronts the Doctor's future.
It confronts the other greatest piece of British mythology of all time. And we haven't really seen it done in media. Monty Python and John Borman's Excalibur do not count as current, you know, as current modern reinterpretations. The closest, in fact, we had in media at the time was, and I was already starting to really date, which is, of course, Tolkien.
Yes.
And whatever media representations of Lord of the Rings. So, which isn't really exactly Arthurian, but it's probably the closest that we had. Yeah, the King Arthur myth is right up there with the Nibelung.
Yeah, we're about almost 10 years on from Ralph Bakshi's attempts to do the Lord of the Rings animated films, which tripped me out as a kid.
And they're actually so bloody Wagner anyway. He's taken it all from the Norse stuff. So,
In the extended version of Battlefield, because this, Nathan, you've mentioned this problem of, you know, they write too much material.
Yeah.
And it's a big thing this season. Pretty much every story this season overruns in terms of shot material. And there's a bit that's on the special edition DVD. And it wasn't actually cut because of time. It was cut because it didn't look very good. It's the Doctor and Ace walking up a spiral staircase to get to Arthur's spaceship. But they cut the bit where Ace is asking how magic exists. And the Doctor explains, have you heard of Clark's Law? Which is any form of sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And the Doctor has the wonderful line of the reverse is also true. Any form of significantly advanced magic is indistinguishable from technology. So I actually think that is, you know, that's a take on the Demon's explanation, but it's much better and it's not...
It's drier and wittier.
Yeah. You know, we kind of agreed that Pertwee is a bit patronising towards Miss Hawthorne, which is in keeping
with character story.
Every single person. Joe, here's your superior officer.
He's even a little bit withering at the maypole, isn't he? I'm glad you're mentioning cut scenes, because that's where this story gets interesting. Have you watched the elongated?
I have, ages ago.
I did for this one.
Yeah.
Most of the cut scenes, well, there's a line in any of them anyway. They mention that this is the time of the Azanian ceasefire that's occupying most of UNIT forces. It was one of the proposed names for a post-apartheid South Africa, which, you know, sadly when Nelson Mandela led a multiracial democracy, he didn't turn to Evelyn Waugh for inspiration, oddly enough. But it is mentioned in Scoop.
Right.
And it was one of the perceived things. So we're actually now back in an Evelyn Waugh universe.
Which is nice. I like
all right, we probably aren't. But you could be. So, again, it's tagging and feeling into other great British literary, there's the word,
Yeah, tropes. No, no.
Go on.
Say what I was going to say
just
is
to,
that
just to pleasure our listeners. Tropes.
Bingo cards at the ready.
What I was going to say is that, of course, Aronovich's first story goes back in time to look at the history of the program in Remembrance of the Daleks.
Yes.
And now his story is the opposite of that. He's going forward in time. But
sideways.
Still,
in, what, sideways to ITV, in yes.
Yeah, and using it as a way of also examining the past of the program by bringing us back the Unity era, but also by talking about Doctor Who being a new modern thing. Like this time, Doctor Who is set in the distant future of 1999, I think.
Ish.
They don't say it in the script, but yeah, I think that that's what it's supposed to be. And so we've got, you know, that stupid phone. Peter Wormsley has a car phone.
Yeah.
I love
the Brigadier doesn't care if it's the king on the phone. So yeah. Doctor Who has killed Queen Elizabeth.
No wonder she was avoiding him down and, you know.
Well, it's their revenge for Silver Nemesis and not being able to get Andrew. Or was it Edward?
It's Edward.
One
but
of them.
Same difference. They're always the glove puppet children on the goodies.
Oh, I did say with it being set in 1999, it's like, oh, yeah, £5 for two soft drinks. I remember those prices.
Yeah, cheap. Yeah. Nice.
This, as you alluded, Nathan, was actually Ben Aronovich's first pitch for the show, Storm Over Avalon.
Yes, because we're Avalon, and that's the so our world is Avalon.
Yeah, in fact, in that extended version, the storm is actually much more of an element in that first episode. You know, there's this big inexplicable storm. It's why the missile convoy is stuck in the mud, and it's clearly associated with the arrival of these knights from an alternative dimension.
In a real Warner Brothers Bugs Bunny way.
but that doesn't really sort of survive the savage cuts that the thing has to undergo.
And that's the problem. It's also a budget cut. I think the reason this doesn't work, and okay, we know the publicity, because it is, Brendan, go on, as far as ratings goes.
We have the lowest rated episode of Doctor Who of the classic season as part of this. The first episode gets 3.1 million.
Which is almost respectable for today's audiences, considering everyone's on an iPad.
For
a first run.
Yeah. The Lie of the Land is the only episode to get a lower first run figure. Now, part of the reason for that was The Lie of the Land was up against the X Factor final, which was unusual because the X Factor final was going to be on Sunday. But Sunday, there was a benefit concert after the Manchester bombings. And pretty much every other channel put something on that wasn't going to rate very well anyway. But that meant moving the X Factor finale opposite Doctor Who, which is why
they should have taken Doctor Who off for that week, really.
Mm.
It was The Lie of the Land. I mean, no big loss.
Yeah. Okay. And yes, and of course, you know, you can see that this is a really even-handed play on Britain at the time and the real dangers that the world was seeing. The wall was just about to come down in Berlin, and Sophie Aldred almost died because of it.
Yeah.
No, she apparently was also got sick from having to stay under the water and try and hold a sword upright. It's real hard to hold this thing straight and maintain an upper middle class disposition.
It's actually really funny, that scene, because she just hands Anselm the sword and says, here, you can be King of England.
Yeah. How's that for post-Thatcher?
For anyone who doesn't know, 10-second version, when Sophie Aldred is in the water tank and it's filling with water, the glass wasn't thick enough. When you see it break on
screen, It bows.
It breaks for real. Water goes over the floor and Sylvester shouts out to everyone, you know, get off the cables, get Sophie out of the tank. And yeah, the glass never broke completely. It just kind of cracked.
It was electrocution that could have actually been the problem.
But also, you know, she could have passed through it and got quite badly cut. And for years afterwards, that studio footage was used in a BBC production safety tape on working with water tanks.
Working with Sophie Aldred.
Working with Sophie Aldred.
Only allowed to do voiceovers. It's not exactly glittering. Yeah, she's only allowed to do voiceovers since Doctor Who.
Hazardous to your health.
It's not very good either, because they clearly
it's terrible.
Well, they don't have enough coverage for that scene. So one of the shots, like there are some shots where the camera's struggling to gain focus.
Yeah.
There's shots where the glass is breaking. And there's shots where studio guys have their sort of hands around Sophie Aldred and a hauling physically.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was pretty much a daily occurrence on the series. As received wisdom will take it.
I have to say, just generally, I don't think this story is very well directed.
It's chunky. And the reason I don't think it works, it's budget and it's time, but it's also props. Those guns, come on. Mm. You know, the armor was meant to be RoboCop looking.
Yeah, yeah.
The
designs were meant to be stock armor, don't they? Which you've seen in lots of other BBC period productions as well. It's probably stuff, you know, that was in Blackadder and things. Like,
yeah.
I think it's the weakest story of Sylvester's era. I think
I would not disagree.
Well, you know, it fights it out down the bottom there with Silver Nemesis. But the fact that these are the weakest stories of the era, I think, is really telling, because I found Battlefield incredibly entertaining.
Much more fun than I remember, and I hadn't watched it for many years.
Yeah. So,
and it has that UNIT comfort food thing going, you know, the fact that UNIT... We're on Earth, which is nice. You know, we're on location a lot. That's really nice.
We're in a lovely part of England. Yep. It's really a holiday brochure to go and get shot for, isn't it? You know, have a nice old witch queen, you know, kill your bint, but she'll also cure blindness.
But you've got the fabulous Jean Marsh in her, what, third appearance in the program?
That's right.
I think the cat disagrees, but no, it is the third appearance.
And she's wonderful. I mean, she's just tremendous.
She really holds it together. It's just on the edge of how of you can see that JNT would have thought, oh, I could get a whole hour of panto out of this and stretch it up. But and she is slightly panto, but she manages to keep it. The scene with the brig and Jean Marsh, or the Vion twins.
Yes, you know, I didn't even think that. That's wonderful, isn't it?
I killed you before. She said, I know you haven't. You just watch yourself, because it's my go now. It's the whole thing of yes. Oh, and yeah, but that's also very Nibelundi, isn't it? Mm. Actually, although it's no, the Arthurian. No, let's not go to those Norsies. I'll go to those IKEA people, you know, with their Alan keying their stories together. No, no, it's an English story. So, of course, it has incest, rape and buggery. And pork pies.
For you Game of Thrones fans out there, there is a shot of the actors who played Jaime Lannister and Euron Greyjoy at the football together, but not looking terribly happy. And someone's put the caption on it, when you are forced to hang out with your sister's new boyfriend.
Now I understand that meme. I've seen that all week and had no idea what it was about. Can we talk about the thematic stuff here? Like, I actually think, well, despite the fact that it is a fun romp in that sort of UNIT style, it does at least attempt to have something to say. And what's interesting about it is that there are two types of soldier in it. There's the Brigadier and the people from UNIT. And, you know, Morgaine recognises that he's a soldier and recognises that he's steeped in blood. He's killed a lot of people. And then there's Morgaine and, you know, all of the people from the parallel universe. And you get those two viewpoints exemplified by Winifred Bambera and Anselin, who have that gorgeous sort of rom-com arc, which I think works so terrifically well and should really have happened all the time in Doctor Who. There should always be a rom-com arc, I think. Yeah.
And it's one of the few times we actually get token extras who are meant to be totty, who are in fact attractive.
Yeah, yeah.
Both Mordred and Anselin, and you think, oh, you know, it depends whether you play, which side of the chessboard you play on, you've got a piece.
Yeah. So there's a scene after the big final battle, you know, which is really incredibly poorly done.
It should have been done with the Yakety Yak theme tune from Benny Hill, and then it would have worked.
Yeah, no, it's not very well directed at all.
It's well, just tighter and less time between them, and maybe a few more mixing the shots up.
Yeah, know, well, it's just a lot of people running around shooting at each other. You get idea of how the battle's going or what's happening or anything.
And it's why people criticise Sylv when he runs in and says, there will be no battle here. And people kind of go, oh, it's completely inappropriate. It's like, no, it's not inappropriate if he's shouting it to 1,000 people, which is what Sylv has read the scene and what the scene is written as. But
however,
as we see it on screen, there's like Mordred and Anselin and one guy off behind a tree who's a bit embarrassed to be in the shot.
It's actually the Californian Monty Python Appreciation Society meeting the Society of a Creative Anachronist who make their own chainmail out of Dad's old beer cans, and they're meeting together. It's not going to work.
And the Wigan Women's Country Association reenacting the Battle of Trafalgar.
Oh, how delicious.
That's awesome. I remember that. But I'll put that in the show notes. You have to see
actually,
that.
Actually, how good would it have been if they'd been entirely in mud and drag?
The weird thing is, like, with those big battle scenes, the bits I really like are the bits where, you know, Mordred, Anselin and Bambera actually have lines and interaction with each other. Like, there's that great bit where Anselin swans on and Mordred says, "I'll teach you about courage." And Anselin just Marcus Gilbert just completely goes over the top. "Courage from the man who fled the field at Camlann."
Such a bummer, isn't it?
It's just, the thing is, it wouldn't work if he wasn't an Arthurian knight.
Had we had
Kenneth Branagh's endless 4-hour version of Hamlet at this point, I'm not sure.
It's actually really good. Like, everything Branagh does, it's just because it's Branagh that we disparage it. Have you seen Dunkirk yet? Dear listener, go and have a look. It's Branagh's favourite moment because he's hardly in it. But no, it's really, Branagh has gravitas. Much unlike this episode.
I'm actually looking forward to Kenneth Branagh as Poirot in Murder on the Orient Express with Judi Dench and Daisy Ridley.
It's butch as that.
both as Miss Lemon.
Meanwhile.
And then we get that great bit at the end where Anselin and Mordred are having their sword fight and the Doctor wanders in between them and, "Hello!" And
yes,
they both
lovely.
Do a double take, which shouldn't work.
But it really does.
And I think it's one of the few instances where just having a static camera works because it lets the actors do their job.
I'm just hoping that Jodie Whittaker puts on one of Nicole Kidman's old cast-off ginger wigs and then we could redo this. I have been waiting all this time for the Ginger Doctor, and we all have been. It's even, you know, everybody thought that Tennant was lampooning Chris Evans when he says, "Am I ginger?" And it was a take on Billy's ex-husband in Doctor. But no, he's actually referencing this story.
Because in the novelisation, which is actually by Mark Platt.
But it's good.
Well, Ben Aronovich used to not be able to write.
He's notorious having a hissy and not using a backup.
Yeah, well, so Mark Platt had to step in and finish the novelisation. Yeah.
He was the Kate Orman all the time, wasn't he?
Well, yeah. Kate Orman had to step in and finish one of his New Adventures novels.
Which, spoiler alert, is one where a main character dies and it was delayed by about five. It was technically brought out after Virgin had lost the license.
It's
and
so
it was
vile
just
a scene, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a good grace arrangement with the BBC.
But they'd already published the novels that came after that in which character was dead.
Yeah.
And, of course, now he's a very successful novelist. But it is a very good novelization, I think. It again, like Aronovich's Remembrance of the Daleks, it spends a lot of time in the characters' heads telling us a little bit more about what they think. But can I just get back to that sort of conflict between two kinds of ways of looking at soldiering? So at the end of that battle, there's a scene where Anselin and Winifred are resting afterwards, and Winifred sees the dead body of the guard captain, the young man who gets one or two lines earlier on, and he's died. And she's sad about that, and Anselin says something about it being a glorious battle, and she looks at him in horror. And in that moment, our conception of the way war works, where it's deplorable and tragic and not glorious, not something that we should be proud of, that scene is superior. Hmm. But then at the very end, the way that Jean Marsh is defeated, you know, the Doctor doesn't cross some wires or press buttons or do something to defeat the enemy in this.
He persuades her in Scottish.
But yes, what he persuades her of is the superiority of her own morality as a warrior.
He poshes it up, doesn't he?
Well, he just says you wouldn't deploy weapons of mass destruction against civilian populations.
Thatcher.
Yes. Yeah. And that's what
Tony Blair.
Exactly. That's what this is about. You know, like the nuclear weapon convoy, which is taken straight from Mind of Evil, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
You know, the nuclear weapon is there to... Yeah, it's there to embody our attitude to war, which is vast deaths among innocent civilian populations.
Yeah, and it goes back to what the Doctor said in Happiness Patrol, and it goes back to something that Mordred does to the Doctor here, look me in the eye, end my life.
And it predicates survival in a really nice, gee, this is a good, these are good 3 years of Doctor Who.
But, yeah, that scene is so powerful. And the Doctor's speech, you know, a child turns its eyes to the sun and its eyes turn to cinders. Yes. When I hear that, I think of Sarah Connor's nightmare in Terminator 2 when she's standing outside the playground.
Of course.
And I know Spielberg watched Doctor Who. I don't know if James Cameron did.
They all did.
Yeah. Well, you know, Joe Michael Straczynski says he did, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, all those,
George
all those
people. Stole. I think it's more, you know, it's easy enough to say. Empress of Mars is entirely a George Lucas rift. You know, it was actually George ghosting on that story. There is no Mark Gatiss, we all know.
No, there's only Sam Kisgard.
but God, we are so fan.
Something else it presages is Ace's attitude to racism, which will become important in Ghostlight and in Survival and in the New Adventures.
I am a little bit disappointed. I know it's the 80s and we get it with Benny Summerfield in the books, but I'm a little bit disappointed she's not a little bit girl on girl, because a lot of young ladies watching this were getting their very first, you know, and we know this from even at the time and certainly now, it wasn't just the little boys having a girl, a companion they could actually identify with. Young queer women were saying, this is the first time I've actually felt involved in Doctor Who. I am now being represented. So just a little bit of flirtation would have been nice.
Yeah, yeah.
With,
I mean,
with one or two of the guilds, why not? Oh, we get that in Ghostlight. What am I saying? But who knows what's going on behind those screens?
But also in this last season is just when Ace starts developing as a romantic or sexually interested character.
Girl.
I'm not a little girl anymore. Captain Sorin. We don't really see it in this story, but we see it. We see it there. And we did have a little bit of it with Mike last year, of course. But
we've really moved on from here to the 70s, haven't we? Yeah. We really have.
But also, I think, and, you know, I'm not quite knowing whereof I speak here, but I think Ace could be seen as a role model for queer women because in terms of the mold of the Doctor Who assistant, she is already queer in that she, you know, her interest in explosives and fighting and her physical attitude and her sort of righteous anger about things. We haven't really seen that in any other Doctor Who companion except Leela.
And it's entirely, and it's entirely appropriate for a period where there was an illness decimating the community.
Another deleted scene in this, of course, is when the Brigadier just reduces Ace to the latest one and she gets really annoyed about that.
She does face, doesn't
she? Yeah, yeah. And she storms off and the Brigadier says, oh, I just can't understand women. And the thing is, I think that scene kind of critiques that old-fashioned attitude without moralizing or sermonizing. You know, it happens organically. And I love the Doctor's response, which is, don't worry, Brigadier, people will be shooting at you soon. Which is why later on in the car, the Doctor's like to the Brigadier, are you happy now?
It does feel as if everyone's on holiday, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Despite the death. In fact, the deathiness, that's the thing. There's no real threat of deathiness in this. And that's what kind of lets it down. It's lovely. It's light and frothy. And you've got everyone working terribly hard to say, no, no, it's actually serious. And people are going, no, they're not going to get hurt at all unless it's by a low-flying Eccles cake or, you know, one of those bloody pork pies again or a scabbard. That's the most threatening thing in this whole production.
I do think that the one death in this that's really effective, and we touched on it earlier, is the death of Flight Lieutenant Lavelle.
Thank you. That is actually the only poignant moment, isn't it?
Yeah,
and it's handled quite well, do you think?
Yeah, it's handled quite well. It's, I mean, Lavelle...
With a dustbuster, yes.
Aside from Bambera, Lavelle is given the most character development of the new soldiers, and she's really fun and likable. Like,
and dry.
Do you speak Czech, Lieutenant? Only when I'm drunk, sir.
So, what have you got on you?
But having her a young woman as well, and having the Brigadier kind of misgendering the new Brigadier, you know, because he's such a crusty old thing. And she is really sort of terribly sweet. She's got a foreign accent, so she's not English like Unit was back in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. She is really good, and I think the way that she's killed by Jean Marsh's character is another way of selling her alien morality. You know, she'll kill Lavelle, but then pick up the tab, you know.
I mean, I especially
like
love...
Like all good killers should.
Lavelle confronting Mordred, and he says, "Am I to do nothing? Well, you can get the tab if you want." And he's like, "Yeah, you know." And it's that thing you were talking about earlier, Nathan. They see each other as warriors, and they understand what that means. And yet, that bit where Jean Marsh restores Pat's eyesight, played by Beryl Reed's girlfriend, June Bland.
Yes.
Yeah, that bit where she restores
with exactly the same haircut. I think she had that haircut from 1962 and she's never got rid of it.
Well, when you're onto a good thing.
Oh. But she's very good in this, isn't she?
Yeah.
She's much better than she was in Earthshock.
Mm. She does some terribly unconvincing braille reading.
She's not meant to be able to see what she's doing, Nathan. Obviously, so judgy.
Like she's playing the piano, though.
I read a wonderful opinion piece. Well, I say wonderful. Wonderful in terms of its evocativeness and terrible in what it was about. A blind woman whose husband, of course, parks in disabled spots when he's taking her places, and they constantly get challenged, despite the fact she's got a cane and glasses. And she finishes the article on what a lot of people don't realise is that not all disabilities are visible.
No.
And I just thought, oh, what an amazing choice of words.
Right. A lot of it is fandom.
Indeed.
Ruin this for me, Chibnall. I'm going to vomit all over my microphone.
Now, of course, the problem with Pat and Elizabeth and Mr. Walmsley is when the plot runs out for them, they're just evacuated at the end of episode 3.
Well, I mean, that is a step up from herding them onto a bus and blowing them up.
That's
though,
true.
We have learned.
That's what you usually do.
They just herd them onto a bus with a bit of casual racism and hypnotism. That bit where Pat challenges Major Husak by saying, "You can't tell me what to do. You're not English, are you?"
Mm. But that's exactly what he would have said.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I really it's realistic. Like
it. And there's the pianoforte peddling of that yes, I mean, they're likable characters, but they're still racist bugs because they are of a certain age and people are like them.
Speaking of both
dismissals, I was going to say, because you were talking about Morgaine in the Caravan of Courage again, which is with all the blinking lights. It does feel very early career Pierce Brosnan, doesn't it? All these dangerous blinking lights could go off at any second.
It's like a terrible set.
Well, he takes the key and as if she's not going to do anything, but that's the point. She will submit to being shackled. Receive fandom at the time was, what a ridiculous ending. You can't leave UNIT to lock her up. She's a star destroyer. She's an enormous delta-shaped wedgie in space that can destroy her, you know.
She could destroy an ornithopter at like 50 paces with just a glance.
But that's the point. It's because it's nobility, you know, and it's morality. Yeah. And she would allow herself to be led away. And she probably just disappears quietly, you know.
In the novelization, the ending is very different. Do you remember this? That someone comes from the parallel world that they're all from to the Brigadier and says, actually, we've got an opening for King of England. So he heads back to replace King Arthur. Did I dream that, or is that a thing that happened?
Let's go back and read it. That'll be worth it, yes.
The thing is, the other thing that topples Morgaine, and this is something, it's a recurring thing in the Sylvester McCoy era, and that is Andrew Cartmell's vision of Doctor Who is that all humanoid beings in some way or another are driven by their love and affection for another. So, yes. You know, the
such
other-
an adult take on what it should have always been that way. It kind of always was, though, except for locking out your
granddaughter.
Yeah, your granddaughter when she gets the first whiff of hormones. We haven't always done it well, have we?
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You know, Doctor Who's approach to love used to just be, and then she runs off with
not
some bloke she's never met.
Not in my good room, you don't. No.
Whereas at the end of the Happiness Patrol, Helena is finally stopped because her dog is dying and she absolutely loves Fifi. And the planet's going to be okay because Earl Sigmar and Susan Q appear to be going on a romance. The Brigadier is asked at the beginning.
She's a bit hot, actually.
Yeah. The Brigadier is asked at the beginning of this by Doris, you know, do I mean so little to you? She's appealing to his love. And Morgaine, you know, her last words are about how much she loved Arthur and now he's gone and she'll never see him again. So what is the point in fighting anymore?
Is this the polarity of duty and love and really what Britain and the Western world were going through at the time on what are we and what are our structures, but who are we? And they're not necessarily the same thing.
And if you think about your own life, dear listener, there's probably a single person or a group of people whose approval and affection and love you kind of base some of your actions on.
Some of the people at home, that could be a group of dogs. Can I just intervene?
Yeah, that's true.
That's pretty even-handed. We're not,
but
yes,
something,
we're not judgy about your pets.
Something we've joked about in the last few episodes is, of course, Ian Levine's reaction to the casting of Jodie Whittaker. But when you
I have such a gentle space for Ian Levine in my heart. I really do. I really get him.
But just like, for instance, okay, we can understand Jean Marsh's character is driven in part by the love for Arthur, which I don't think weakens her character in any way.
No, it strengthens it. It makes it so much more interesting. Mm.
That doesn't excuse that she's killed Lavelle. It just gives us a better understanding.
Well, she saw Lavelle as a peasant. That's why.
Oh, but she sees her as a warrior too.
Yeah, but I think, yes, that's right. Yeah. It's therefore an excuse to do so.
And
she
doesn't kill her out of sadism. She kills her to get information. Now, if you look at something like Game of Thrones, the end of the first episode where Jaime pushes Bran out of the window, he does so with the explanation, the things we do for love.
That's the only book of Game of Thrones I've read, and it's really good in the book.
Yeah. But it's a common feature of very good drama, and it's something
folk out of windows. That's right. But Louise Jamison was there first, though, wasn't she? Long before.
But also remember, it's something that Sylve said was his approach to the character, that his elderly grandmother, who was so sad because everyone she loved was gone.
When she turned to 100 and she said that, that's it. And she was a teetotaler. She was a very careful Scottish Presbyterian lady who never touched alcohol, never smoked cigarettes. And she hoisted up her skirts and said, that's it. And started on the whiskey and fags, and she died 3 years later, and he said the last 3 years were the happiest she ever had.
If that story's not
it's
true.
It's true.
It's got to be made true. Retrospectively. It's awesome.
Yeah. But, you know, all of a sudden, Doctor Who is talking about the power of love, and it's not... And this isn't an indictment of the new series, but there are quite a few stories in the new series where the power of love defeats aliens because aliens don't understand what love is.
Yeah.
Whereas this
is...
a
black cube. Oh, honestly, Stephen Moffat.
Whereas...
This is one of my favourite stories he's done. Yeah, go on.
Well, that's by Chibnall.
Yeah, I don't get it.
But
so is Exit Wounds and Cyber Lady Person. Just in case we're still on the subject.
But here, love is seen as a driving force for various characters, you know, for Pat and Elizabeth, for the Brigadier, for Morgaine, and to a lesser extent as the story goes on, because they're just getting to know each other, Bambera and Anselin.
Yeah. And Mordred. Mordred loves his mum.
Oh, yeah.
Way too much.
Yeah, and you know
but
what?
He is the child of an incestual relationship, so it's no wonder.
Mm-hmm. I do have to say, I think Christopher Bowen's performance is probably the weakest in the story. He's Mordred. I don't really get where he's going with his performance. He gets a few good moments.
He gets to be snarly and have lovely, pretty... rich boy hair, and he actually thinks he's just presenting the boat race folk. He's really just a rich kid.
Yeah. He's like Eric Trump talking about his father, you know.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. He is.
Make Avalion great again. In particular, and I know it's gauche to talk about this, but the laughing scene. And I do have to wonder if just the comms unit to the floor manager was down and they're saying, he can stop laughing now.
God, Christopher, stop.
That always goes into the Panto Christmas party outtake scenes. They always do that. No, just
keep it going.
It's gorgeous job, Chris. Gorgeous.
I do have to say, I've seen him in other things, and he's great. He's not a bad actor. I just think he misses the mark in this. I don't think he does.
I think he's playing spoiled, shallow rich boy really well.
And I also think he's getting the tone of the production, and it might not be the tone that we wanted, but it but is the tone that we get.
It's the tone that we deserve.
It's actually the held over late broadcast Christmas pantos.
Yeah. And like, it's fun and light, you know, the script clearly doesn't want it to be. The script clearly wants it to be a bit more serious, but the production clearly decides to go summary and ridiculous, and that's okay. That's one of the reasons why it's entertaining.
And we do, of course, now have the neon blue TARDIS as it was repainted at the end of the Happiness Patrol, much to the chagrin of Clayton Hickman.
Yeah, I actually think it's gorgeous. It goes with the whole feel.
If you're not following Clayton Hickman on Twitter, please do. He posts rare photos of TARDISes.
He's marvellous.
And, for instance, he's explained why the First Doctor's TARDIS in the upcoming Christmas special doesn't have the white windows, because halfway through the War Machines...
We all knew that, didn't we?
But there were about 3 weeks where he just had to retweet it once a week, and he's like,
wasting battery power, you're typing that out. We all knew that.
But he kept having to retweet it saying, I'm having to explain this to people again. I wasn't angry about it before.
Here is frustration, can't you?
But yeah, if you're not following him on Twitter, he's seriously lovely, so please do. One other thing I would like to mention in this episode, because during our viewing marathon, Nathan and I had different opinions on this, and so Richard, I'd be interested to hear yours. The scene in the circle where Ace and Xiao Yung, can we just mention, a non-white supporting character, once again, much like Earl Sigma last year. So Doctor Who is trying to get non-white faces on screen, which is fantastic. In general, I really like her. I think she's a good foil for Ace. In the circle scene where Morgaine starts manipulating them and... Xiao Yung starts talking about how Ace is a juvenile delinquent, and Ace fires back with pretty much racist abuse. What do we think of that scene?
Does she?
Yeah, she does. It's really hard to hear. And
yes, like, I didn't pick that up.
We're discussing it on Twitter with friend of the podcast, Andrew Hodson, and I may have misheard what's said, and I don't want to say it, do you know what I mean, on this podcast. But the trouble with it, and it's an unavoidable problem, I think, in that you aren't going to really broadcast, you know, on a show where she constantly calls people bilge bag and toe rag and stuff, like her kind of abuse is always...
Fu Manchu talons and fingers. Does she say anything like that?
But she's never going to say anything that sounds like a real racial slur.
Yeah,
and so it is kids' TV racial slur, and it is... She sort of swallows it as if she's embarrassed by it. She certainly says it really quickly. Look, I think
I don't mind having those things brought to the surface.
I don't think that's bad either. I just don't think the scene quite works.
It's just nice to have another young lady who doesn't have elongated fingernails in this one.
Well, I mean,
Freddy Krueger fingernails.
It would have been nice to have Xiao Yung in the show without having to make a point of her race at some point in the story.
That's true. Yeah, but it's a point of crisis. It's unwrapping of the id, and you know, the removal of the superego, and the seeing of what are the real flaws, and what with the truth is in both of these young people. So, of course, it could actually just be a projection of. I keep wanting to refer to her as the girl from the Tomorrow People, because she didn't register for me as a character, which is a nice thing. She registered for me as just another girl in the show. So I agree with you. And that's probably why it is a shock and why I missed it, because you don't read her that way. So when there is a racist slur, it's because that Dorothy is your fears, and probably the other girl's great fears that are being projected and that Ace is picking up on.
Yeah.
They all pick that they seem to be mirroring each other's darkness. Yeah. So it does make sense that, you've seen my shame or what I fear.
Yeah.
I think it works really well. I really like that scene. It could have been cripplingly Celestial Toymaker-y, but it gets to the nub.
Oh, and I quite like then Jean Marsh appears and she's underlit because she's outside of the bright circle. And
also not as young as she was.
But there's also the thing too where the whole point is that she's got to protect the sword, and when she fails to do that, the Doctor isn't angry at her. Yeah. Like she expects it to be a failure.
Yeah.
She's failed, but in fact, you know, provided that she stayed alive.
It's interesting that Morgaine let them live.
Mm. Yeah, again, she does have a different morality.
I think that's respect for Merlin.
Yeah. And also that they are non-combatants, they are not soldiers.
Yeah. Oh, very true.
I said a few weeks ago that there was one scene where I thought Sylve just doesn't get the line reading right, and it's actually when he comes back to the hotel when Morgaine is attacking Ace and Xiao Yung. If they're dead! it's like he's going for, if they're dead... And also trying to shout it at the same time. And it just, I don't get what he's going for in that.
It's very Pierce Brosnan-y.
That's what you call everything bad these days, Richard. Can't really? Dinner? You know, the weather?
Malcolm Turnbull's very Pierce Brosnan-y. Actually, that could be dated by the time we put this out. He may not be Prime Minister anymore.
That'd be interesting. Yeah. Who knows?
We could have a potato as Prime Minister instead of a bag of rice.
Wow. Anyone for chips?
So we've got the tag scene, which feels like the end of one of the early Emma Peel Colour Avengers episodes. Yes. Nathan, you may not have seen these, but... So, season four of the Avengers...
All the black and white ones, when they drive off in a thing.
They always drive off in a different vehicle, something related to the episode.
Yeah.
They continue that in the first Colour season, but it's always the same country house they're driving away from. They have a little conversation inside, and then all of a sudden they're out in some weird car and drive out through the gate, and that's the tag scene. And that's what this feels like to me. Because you've got the Brigadier, Anselin, and the Doctor sitting out in the garden. And then it turns out that all the female leads, so Doris, Bambera, Xiao Yung, and Ace, are going off for a drive in town.
Shopping.
Yeah.
Because that's what girls do.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't mind it.
But no.
And
I wish Morgaine had been there as well. She could have gone shopping as well. Wouldn't that have been awesome?
What is this thing you call shopping?
It's a very carry-on kind of ending, isn't it? It feels like the cover of the Beano or the Dandy Christmas special.
But the script is originally heading towards the death of the Brigadier.
Yes, yeah.
And so we would have had a very, very different ending from that. But the show is no longer as cynical as it once was.
And the previous 3 3/4 episodes would not have supported that tone.
Exactly. No, exactly. Yeah. The tone would have been quite wrong. And so it's so a wrong. Lovely ending. Mm. And there is that thing, we'll bring a major character back and kill them. That's drama. That's so exciting. But it's such a...
That's
adolescent, Saywardian kind of...
Brosnian.
You know, version of drama. Whereas this, I think, is so light and so funny. It gets sort of ludicrous, keffy comedy cartoon music at the end of it.
Yeah. Which, you know, works for once. I do think this is Kef's worst score for the show.
Oh, that's a...
Yeah. It's a big ask, I know. But, you know, okay... There's a piece in Paradise Tower which is worse than anything in this story, and that's the March of the Cleaners, which I've already mentioned.
Yeah.
Like, when they have a cleaner going down a corridor, shall we speed up the footage? No, let's just put on this 60-second piece of da-dun, 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 dun, da-dun, dun.
Yeah, I was going to say, it makes the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, and as I was doing that, Richard covered Sutek's ears, so she wasn't upset. But yeah, the scene is so lovely. And yeah, the death of the Brig would have been terrible. In the broadcast version and the special edition version, I haven't watched the two scenes back to back, but the scene in the special edition version where the Doctor's saying, you know, you were meant to die in bed and cradling the Brigadier in his arms, I think they must have done something to the footage, because in the broadcast version, Nick Courtney is just sitting there blinking. But in the special edition version, maybe I just haven't noticed, but I think they've like composited earlier frames onto his face, so his face is still. But the Brig just waking up and saying, of course I didn't stay inside. It's like, that is totally in character. You know, back in season 10 and season 11, we kind of criticised that he'd become Colonel Blimp. Mm. But he's really back in force in this one.
I love him in Spearhead from Space.
Yeah.
In his jolly rompers and just the sly and saturnine. You know, this is really Department S unit. This is the BBC being terribly glamorous, my dear. I can't wait to get popping your little vesty thing that you're wearing right now.
You're expecting him to be the sort of dumb, unimaginative straight man. But in fact,
later on, yes. But that's not how he was written.
No, he's amused by the Doctor and gorgeous amused by Liz. It's
how lovely
wonderful.
Was he in The Invasion? He was the slick, cool. And what about Web of Fear when he was the saturnine anti-hero? Courtney's had a great... Oh, Brett Vian.
Yeah. No, this is his final appearance, obviously, in the classic series. So, you know, it was an incredible career and really worth celebrating, I think. Mm-hmm. He was spectacular.
And that's what the story has become. And it is a later edition. There was no Brigadier written into the story. It was J&T's suggestion. Mm. Oh, well, if you're having a Brig, why don't we use this one? Because she was a USAF colonel, wasn't she?
I think that's right.
And meant to be American.
Yeah, back in Silver Nemesis, Nicholas Courtney was one of the tourists wandering around Windsor, and that's when he got chatting to J&T, and J&T said...
Got a job.
Yeah. Well, it was actually J&T who said to him, hey, if we wrote a script would you like to come back? And he said, oh, yes, please. And Dante said, what if we killed you off in a blaze of glory? Oh, yes, please. Because, you know, any actor wants to do a death scene.
Yeah. But, I mean,
I'm glad
they didn't. It would have been inappropriate. And I love that sign. You were meant to die in your sleep. And then, of course, Russell would have really stuck to that for Sarah Jane. It's just lovely. Mm. And a really appropriate send-off.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is his story. I don't mind that it's his story. He deserves it. But I do wish he'd been Brett Vian.
Dear listeners, Sylvester McCoy has just cooked us a lovely supper, but now we're off to somewhere where you really don't want to try the soup. We'll see you next week for Ghostlight. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Over on Bondfinger, we are on a top of things with the Pierce Brosnan era of James Bond. You can find that at bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and Apple Podcasts, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. Until next time, boom! Thank you very much for listening. Good night.
Good night.
Good everything.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb, logo designed by Anthony Wells. This episode, Why Is It Up Everything, was recorded on the 6th of August 2017. The next episode will be released on the 22nd of October. Fans of parallel worlds in Doctor Who will enjoy Pete's World, the world with fascists boiling in lava, and the world where people's rights aren't subject to a ridiculous postal survey.
It's the one where she saves the world thinking of her mum.
Again.
Again.
And a puddle. I left a puddle on the floor. There's a whole euphemism there for ladies.
Honestly. Some moistened bint throwing around spaceships is no representative basis for government.
Oh, dear. Okay. And yes, and of course, you know, you can see that this.